From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made tragically near Cleveland, Ohio, between the week of Christmas and New Year's Eve. Kathleen Cochran DePiro was a former television news reporter and anchor, and I knew her from our days at Ohio University, where Kathleen and I anchored alongside one another several times. She was a successful news reporter. She gracefully handled a news report that you might have even seen. It went viral about 10 years ago. It was a local reporter, Kathleen, introducing one of her taped reports. She was holding a cat who was not pleased to be held. The cat took some angry swipes at Kathleen's face, and later Kathleen gave herself a little ribbing, joking she was clearly not a cat person, but she was fine. And you know what? You can't handle a hard moment any better than that. So maybe that was what she was best known for across the country, but she was also known for being a hardworking and successful reporter and a mom in the markets where she worked, in North Carolina and Ohio. In recent years, she left news reporting to stay home full-time with her young children. Well, a few days after Christmas this past year, she woke up feeling ill. Within 36 hours, she had died. Spectrum News reported that her shocking death was likely caused by the flu, leading to septic shock. This has been a particularly rough flu season. Several dozen children have died across the country, according to the CDC. From October 1st to January 20th, there were nearly 12,000 confirmed flu-related hospitalizations, and the actual number of flu cases is certainly much higher than that. So why is it so bad this year, and is there anything we can do about it? My guests this hour are here to answer our questions and yours. And listeners, if you want to call the program, this is a good time to have some answers. Let me welcome our guests in studio. Dr. Dave Topham is Associate Professor of Microbiology and Immunology at the University of Rochester Medical Center and Director of the New York Influenza Center of Excellence. Dr. Topham, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you, Evan.
Also here is Dr. Brenna Ticini, Assistant Professor of Infectious Diseases in the Departments of Medicine and Pediatrics at the University of Rochester Medical Center. Dr. Ticini, welcome to you.
Thank you, Evan.
And also here is Dr. Ed Walsh. He is head of infectious diseases at Rochester General Hospital. And Dr. Walsh, welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
I want to start with just the question of the perception versus reality of whether it is worse. You know, I guess worse is number of cases and how deadly or severe the cases might be. And I'll go around the room starting with Dr. Ticini. Is it worse this year, the flu?
We have had a very high rate of flu, and some of this depends on what exactly you look at. Some of the main markers we look at are a number of visits to healthcare settings with flu-like symptoms, as well as laboratory-confirmed cases of influenza. And this so far has been kind of on par with the 2014-2015 season, which was also considered a bad flu year. And in the past couple weeks, it does look like we're having higher rates of flu-like illness visits than even that season.
Dr. Topham, what are you saying?
So I think it's bad this year because there's a mismatch between what's circulating and what's in the egg-grown vaccine. There's a mutation in the vaccine that, at least for some people, unmasks a part of the virus that you wouldn't see in the circulating viruses. So it's not quite the right response. And I think that's why you're seeing so many infections. People are getting vaccinated, but if the vaccine is less effective, then just more people are going to get infected, right? Mm.
Dr. Walsh, what are you seeing?
Yeah, this is a fairly significant flu season. It's a little hard to say whether it's going to be worse than seasons we've seen in prior years. Give you an example. At this time so far this year, we've had 250 hospitalizations at Rochester General. Last year, we had about 240. So we're ahead of that, and we're probably just peaking through the flu season. So we're probably going to be substantially greater than last year.
As always, we're worried about vulnerable populations, young children. We're worried about the elderly. We're worried about those with compromised immune systems. The story that I opened the broadcast with from Cleveland, Ohio, you know, Kathleen was someone who, you know, it was one of those friendships for me where, you know, we were Facebook friends, but hadn't seen her much over the years. But she was always successful and someone I knew from college, super fit, young mom. You know, I think I'm pretty young, and so was she. And everyone was just shocked that in 36 hours she went from waking up not feeling well to being gone. And I think of that family and I just ache for them. And Dr. Walsh, I want to talk a little bit before we start taking some phone calls from listeners. And already the phones are ringing. Listeners, you can call the program with comments or questions on the flu and related illnesses. 844-295-TALK. It's 844-295-8255. Or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. I confess, I hear about sepsis. I don't know much about what exactly it is. And I don't know if in a death like this, you would say that is a flu-related death or that is a septic shock death, or are they related to one another? Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, they're related to each other. It's well known that influenza, which is a virus, will occur in patients who at the same time may be colonized in their upper respiratory tract with a very virulent bacteria such as group A strep, Staph aureus, especially the MRSA type, as well as pneumococcus. And if you go back historically and look at flu deaths, a significant proportion are related to the bacterial superinfection that occurs either simultaneously with the flu or even up to 2 weeks later. The influenza itself predisposes you to developing these serious invasive bacterial infections. And from the description that you provided and your friend, it would sound as if that may very well have been a bacterial superinfection. Of course, you'd need the actual medical records
absolutely.
To know this.
Yeah, and Dr. Topham, I guess for many people in that circle who knew her, it wasn't just a case of, wow, this is someone who got who passed away from an illness that we didn't expect. It's that it happened so quickly. Is that unusual?
No. Well, it's unusual in the sense that most people don't die of an influenza infection. Right. That's fairly rare,
sure.
Especially if you're healthy. It tends to affect the elderly or people with underlying health conditions. And the very young, so it's enigmatic in somebody that's young and healthy to have this happen. But as Ed said, if there's a co-infection present at the same time the flu is there, then your chances of developing more severe complications goes way up.
Hmm. Dr. Tassini, anything you want to add there?
I think that sums it up. That the influenza is part of the picture. In that it's not in isolation.
Well, I want to grab our first phone call and stress to listeners again. We're going to try to define different terms. And Sarah, I already got an email from Sarah saying, circle back to sepsis. We'll do that, Sarah. We'll talk about, again, what that is and what you ought to know about it. But let me grab Malcolm in Rochester, who's waiting on the phone first up. Go ahead, Malcolm.
Hello. I feel I'm a victim of the HIPAA regulations. I live in a senior citizen setting, and we can learn whether Mary Small or Bill Smith has gone to the hospital, but we can't learn why they went, and so I may be exposed to flu and never know about it until the foul virus strikes me, which it did suddenly on Saturday evening. I felt responsible to contact everyone I'd seen that day and warn them of my problem, but I don't get HIPAA regulations prevent me from learning about what went before, and I will not learn what happened afterward. Thank you.
Malcolm, thank you for the phone call. Obviously, HIPAA is in place for a reason, but let's just talk about, and Dr. Tassini, he's concerned that when people from his facility are hospitalized mm-hmm. and he doesn't know why, it could put him at risk. What would you say to that?
I would say that we do have communication between the hospitals and long-term care facilities while maintaining individual patients' privacy and confidentiality. If there is an infectious concern on part of our hospital's epidemiology infection prevention team. And we have a lot of communication and work with the county health department as well to ensure that anyone in contact, close contact with persons with influenza are evaluated.
Malcolm had said he thinks he has the flu now. What would you urge him to do? Make sure he's consulting with doctors, I assume, right?
Exactly. If there's a medical director of, I don't know where he is and don't need to know specifically, but yeah, to get in touch with his personal physician or the medical staff.
And he also indicated that he believes that there are times when someone may be released from the hospital back to the facility where he's living, but still be contagious with something like the flu. Is that likely?
And again, there's a lot of communication between hospitals and other facilities where they're discharged. And with any infection, there are things put in place to ensure the safety of others at the facility, and that's a top priority.
All right, Dr. Topham, Malcolm is concerned about spread of the flu. What are the most common ways it spreads?
The most common ways it spread, you know, you can be in the same room with somebody and the virus can spread just by having them breathe, never mind coughing. But it's also spread by touch, right? And so we talk a lot about good hand hygiene and hand washing because that actually helps cut down rates of transmission as well. But you can't do anything about people breathing in the same room. And somebody might be infected and not know it.
All right. So, Dr. Walsh, if someone does get a flu diagnosis, what is the sort of the typical protocol, assuming I guess there is such a thing as a typical case, and I know there's lots of variables, but a typical protocol on how long someone will be contagious?
Well, generally speaking, people will shed virus in an infectious quantity for anywhere from 5 to 10 days. The most significant transmission is going to occur either just prior to the onset of the symptoms and then the next 1 or 2 days. And then the amount of virus shed does tend to fall. And so the most contagion tends to occur in that early phase.
All right. I'm a parent of an almost six-year-old, and the interesting thing for me, especially with a child in my first child in kindergarten, so first time I'm going through how a school system deals with it during flu season, they're generally telling you, you know, parents, if there is fever, throwing up, or diarrhea, keep them home. You know, if they're coughing, unfortunately, this time of year, there's a lot of coughs. And so my boy was sick last week, you know, pretty significantly sick. So forgive the super ignorant question, but I do want to know something that's been just driving me, not crazy, I'm just fascinated by it, is children's, I guess it's ibuprofen, right? Or the various knockoffs. That is like a wonder drug for my son. And what I want to know is that placebo or is that actually happening? Like something actually happening with him? You're laughing at me, Dr. Tassini. Why are you laughing?
No, I love when ibuprofen is the wonder drug and not antibiotics or something else. So ibuprofen does have great effect at in both analgesia, so relieving pain, mm-hmm. and that's a lot of what really takes kids out when they have any kind of illness going on, whether it be influenza or any of the other respiratory viral illnesses, as well as fever-reducing abilities. So that also makes them feel better. So those two things together does make it helpful in managing the symptoms and allowing your child to fight off the virus himself.
Is there also a placebo effect where he thinks, I took medicine and I'm going to rally now? Maybe.
There could be with all of us effect of any medicine we take.
But ibuprofen is reducing fever. It is impacting pain. Okay.
Correct.
I'm amazed, and it's usually within an hour or less, and I'm just amazed at the change. And so he missed very little time in terms of learning last week, and no diagnosis of the flu or anything like that. But Dr. Topham, for parents who are, you know, thinking about symptoms, one of the things I hear a lot is, well, I've got the flu. Or so I talked to a friend who recently told me that her parents have, quote unquote, the flu. But she said they're sick. They haven't been diagnosed with anything. And certainly they're definitely sick. But sometimes people use the term flu the way we use. Some people use the word Coke when they mean soda. Is there a concern that you have with overusing that term when we don't have a diagnosis?
Oh, absolutely. You know, it's a way overused term. And we use flu for stomach ailments as well as respiratory infections. I'd point out that, you know, flu isn't the only respiratory virus that's going around right now. It's probably the predominant virus, but there are coronaviruses, there's RSV that usually precedes the flu, and the symptoms all look the same. So you really can't tell unless you have a test. Now, you know, if it's purely upper respiratory, it's unlikely to be flu. Flu tends to affect the lower respiratory tract compared to just the nose. So if it's just a runny nose and sneezing, it's probably rhinovirus.
Okay. Dr. Walsh, do you endorse the idea of not using the term the flu unless you know it's influenza?
Yeah, from a medical perspective, absolutely. I mean, we've been studying respiratory viruses for many years in both children and in adults and older adults. And you do see, during the winter season, at least four or five different kinds of viruses. So I think people are using the term flu as a generic illness description. That is, I don't feel good. I have a cough. I have a runny nose or a sore throat.
Or maybe vomiting.
Vomiting would be much more likely to be a different virus, although you can get vomiting with influenza.
Yeah, especially in kids.
And you don't get the vomiting with the other respiratory viruses. So unless you make a specific viral diagnosis, you can't be certain that it's flu. And right now we are seeing several other viruses circulating among the hospitalized adults.
Interesting, though, that vomiting makes it less likely in your mind to be flu. Not that it's impossible by any means, but...
Well, if they have respiratory component,
okay,
and there's vomiting, then influenza would be more likely than some of the other viruses.
Okay. So there we go. So I've said it before. I'm sure I will say it again, but I will try to correct myself next time I'm sick if I say, well, I've got the flu. I usually say if I got the flu if I'm throwing up, which turns out to be not... I'm not a doctor, it turns out.
The infamous stomach flu you're referring to.
The infamous stomach flu?
Yeah, the non-influenza stomach flu.
Which means it doesn't exist?
Correct.
Okay. Let me get
it's not influenza.
Yeah, if it's not influenza. All right. But it still may be something to get checked out. Mm-hmm. David in Rochester on the phone's next. Go ahead, David.
Hi. I'm a member of the University of Rochester AIDS Clinical Trial Group's Community Advisory Board, which oversees clinical trials for the National Institute of Health. In Rochester, we have an enormous number of patients living with HIV and many other unrelated immune compromised conditions in Rochester, just like any other major city in America. But there is absolutely no outreach to the HIV community or to other vulnerable communities in regards to what we're going to do, a public health standard, to protect patients who are already immune compromised from influenza. There isn't any type of public service announcement program going on nationwide or locally. There isn't a lot of screening and diagnosis. And when patients with HIV or other immune compromised conditions get the flu, it's going to potentially be so much worse. If we're on the verge of a much worse flu season, possibly epidemic, like we're seeing in San Diego and around the country right now, we're going to have a situation where our public health measures are going to be strained and taxed beyond previous considerations. And patients who are on antiviral therapy, the complications of taking Tamiflu with those medications when dealing with polypharmacy is going to be a real problem. I'd love to hear the guests talk about what can be done, what the U of R can do, and nationwide, why the CDC and the NIH, how they could be responding and why they're not.
David, thank you for the phone call. I guess I'll start with Dr. Dave Topham, who is the director of the New York Influenza Center of Excellence and a professor of microbiology and immunology at the University of Rochester Medical Center. Dr. Topham?
Yeah, so I can see his point that I'm not aware of any particular public health campaigns for people who have HIV, but I'm sure that their physicians would recommend strongly that they get the flu vaccine every year, partly because of the fact that they may be, they are immunocompromised. I don't know, you'd have to ask some of my colleagues here on how somebody with HIV responds to flu vaccine, but I'm going to guess they probably respond okay as long as they're on antiviral therapy.
Okay. Dr. Ticini? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I would echo that, and I appreciate your call and using this forum to get the word out that it's very important for anyone who's at all immunocompromised, and certainly persons with living with HIV infection would fall into that category. It's critical to get your flu vaccine and your pneumonia vaccines. Those are our best mechanisms we have to prevent influenza and the complications of certain types of bacterial pneumonia with influenza. I would urge anyone to go to their healthcare provider. I know patients we care for in our clinics are strongly urged to get their vaccines and to seek attention should you be exposed to flu or develop symptoms, to discuss the risks and benefits of possible antiviral treatment with oseltamivir or Tamiflu is a trade name he mentioned.
Okay. And Dr. Walsh?
Well, I would agree with that.
Okay, very good. Brian emails the program and says, just wants to make a point that it's not heroic to go to work sick and wants to know if the doctors on your panel are tired of hearing about people with perfect attendance. Doesn't this just mean we're putting more people at risk in the workplace? A lot of smiles around the table. Dr. Walsh, you want to start there?
Sure, it's absolutely true. I mean, people do go to work when they're sick, and they are placing others that they work with at risk, and all of the respiratory viruses can be spread. So it doesn't just hold for flu, but it holds for other viruses. We have general principles about what would allow you to come to work. One of them is fever. We sort of use the rules that the schools use, that if you have a fever, you shouldn't be working. But that doesn't completely eliminate the possibility that you'd have a afebrile influenza or other respiratory virus infection and couldn't spread that around your office or as in the setting of a healthcare situation. Of course, our biggest concern is nosocomial influenza. And each year we do see occasional spread of influenza within institutions from patient to staff and also vice versa from staff to the patients.
So Dr. Topham, we're here to take people down a peg for all that boasting about perfect attendance?
Yeah, so, you know, somebody, I won't say who said this, but it came down with a respiratory infection, and she was extolling the virtues of DayQuil and how it ameliorated all her symptoms. And that's great, which meant she doesn't feel sick anymore, but came to work anyway, right? So I think, you know, if it's possible in the kind of job that you have to stay home when you're sick, that's probably a good idea to protect your coworkers. We joke in the lab that, you know, some people are afraid to come to my lab because we work with a lot of viruses, right? I would say the lab is much safer than the cafeteria or, you know, a lobby, an airplane, a bus. You know, that's really where, you know, people congregate and you get these things.
I'm going to turn to Dr. Tassini on the kids' side of this. Let's go back to the schools because I missed a chance to follow up and find out if I'm describing this accurately or if this should be sort of the accurate scenario. First of all, I mentioned that the school guidelines for my son are fever, vomiting, diarrhea, keep him home. Otherwise, generally speaking, you know, if he's mm-hmm. if the kind of they're up and moving and maybe not 100%, they can still go. Is that kind of the general rule? Fair enough?
That is a general rule, but I think we do need to use our common sense or what we like to call clinical judgment. And, you know, if your child's coughing all over the place, you know, would you want your coworker sitting next to you in that state? And think about that. Do you want your child in the school? They're, you know, in the classroom with a bunch of other kids in the school cafeteria. Would you want, you know, the person sitting next to your child going to school with those symptoms?
Okay. And when it comes to kids and influenza itself, mm-hmm. kids and the actual flu, not the mythical stomach flu, but the actual flu, I had a listener who just wants to make sure that we are hitting the symptoms. So if we're saying that stomach flu is a term we use a lot, which means stomach bug, but very different than actual influenza, mm-hmm. Then what are the first things we tend to see? Again, knowing that things are different case to case, but what should we be mm-hmm. looking for with flu itself?
Yeah, at the start, and what can separate it from some of the other respiratory viral infections is that it really affects your whole body. So it's those body aches, chills, people complain of headache and pain behind their eyes. Those are some of the first things to come on. And then fever can often come on before you even have the cough. And you can develop the cough, sore throat, and over the first 3 days or so, I would say some constellation of that.
Okay.
And I would add that, you know, one of the distinguishing features of flu in many people, not all, is that it comes on very quickly, right? You may be feeling fine, and within 2 hours, I mean, I've watched my own kids and have seen this happen where they're running around and they're fine. Literally within 2 hours, they're curled up in a ball on the floor with a fever and the body aches and the whole nine yards. And there aren't, I don't think there are any other viruses that are quite like that.
Yeah. All right, and so when it comes to, again, going back to that miracle drug, kids' ibuprofen, that's not going to have much of a dent on actual flu, right? Is that a good
It'll
guess?
It'll still show through.
It'll show that, through.
Yeah.
And
okay.
it's masking the symptoms, right? They're still infected and shedding, right? It's just controlling the fever. So
which goes back to your colleague and,
yes.
and the DayQuil.
Yeah.
You can mask those symptoms, but if you're still contagious, you're still contagious.
Yes.
Okay, I've got a couple of phone calls to get to. And listeners, I want to let you know, I've got some other emails. We are going to work through them. So in the second half of this program, it's a good chance to kind of open it up to you and your questions about flu, seasonal illness, and what you'd like to know from our panel of guests on this. You just heard Dr. Dave Topham, an associate professor of microbiology and immunology at the University of Rochester Medical Center and the director of the New York Influenza Center of Excellence, and Dr. Brenda Ticini, assistant professor of infectious diseases in the Departments of Medicine and Pediatrics at the University of Rochester Medical Center, the associate hospital epidemiologist for Strong Memorial Hospital and Golisano Children's Hospital, and Dr. Ed Walsh, head of infectious diseases at Rochester General Hospital. Your phone calls and more of your emails and questions on the flu and related coming up right after this break on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, we stick with the medical theme and we'll be answering your questions on heart failure and heart disease. If you have any questions related to heart health, it's a great chance to have them answered. And we'll talk about what heart failure is and is not, and what it means for patients. It's not the same for everybody. There are different treatments and even technologies you ought to know about. We'll discuss it all next hour on Connections. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Let's get some of your phone calls in. This is Keith in Parenton. Go ahead, Keith.
Hi. I just had two questions. The first one is it possible to have the flu without any symptoms? And my second question is, whether or not you do have symptoms, does the flu ever affect your heart?
Two very good questions. Thank you, Keith. I appreciate that. We'll go around the room. Dr. Walsh?
Yeah, I mean, it's possible to shed influenza virus with, I perhaps wouldn't say no symptoms, but very minimal symptoms where you really wouldn't think you've got much of an illness at all. As far as the affecting the heart, that's a very significant issue. There is what we would know as a sort of collateral damage of influenza. And by that, I mean, you'll see peaks in heart attacks and actually strokes as well that occur on the tail end of the flu season or during the flu season. And much of that is actually thought to be due to the inflammatory response that occurs during influenza. That then triggers off thrombosis in coronary arteries or cerebral arteries. Mm. So we do see an increase in heart problems. The other highly at-risk group are people with congestive failure because we know that the cardiac ejection fraction drops during influenza infections, and so the ability of the heart muscle to pump is less good.
Okay. Dr. Topham.
Yeah, I don't know if I have too much to add on that. I leave this to the medical doctors.
Okay. Dr. Ticini?
Yeah, I guess the one thing I would add for our children is that children with what we consider congenital heart disease or also heart disease are at very high risk for complications from influenza.
Okay. Thank you for that, Keith. A couple of comments that came in off air. Christine in Canandaigua says the flu can spread in retail areas, so if employees think they're sick, please don't go into work. It can spread in all areas, Christine, but definitely I understand the point of sort of more enclosed space. And Alex in Rochester says there's pressure as employees to show up to work even when we are sick. That is not something the doctors in the room can address. That is a cultural and societal issue, but they would probably all agree that the more people who go to work sick, the less productive your workplace is going to be when all of a sudden a third of your workforce is out the next week. So there's probably drops. I bet you there's research on drops in productivity somewhere. I don't know, Dave, if you've seen it yourself, but there's probably something.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, we talk about this all the time that, you know, one of the reasons we want everybody to get vaccinated is to reduce illness because it's a huge cost to productivity all over the world, and in the United States. It's in the millions and millions of dollars of lost productivity. So, you know, we get it. Mm-hmm. I was going to also point out, you know, I think understand that if, you know, you've got kids that are sick and you have to go to work. So you have to get them some kind of care, either daycare or not. So I think parents sometimes feel pressured, even if they're not sick, to put their kids back in daycare.
Yeah, or in school. I mean, you feel like you can't miss time. We definitely have that culture. So Alex in Rochester, I take the point and thank you for that. But to the best we can, get a good diagnosis and try to respond to what your doctor is telling you. Let me read an email that just came in on the subject of the vaccine itself. Jillian writes under the heading, Tell the Truth. She says, please tell us about the flu shot this year and its real effectiveness. My pharmacist says the vaccine doesn't cover the particular strain that is killing people.
That's from Jillian. Okay. So she is correct in the sense that the H3 viruses that are circulating differ significantly it's actually a single mutation from what's in the egg-grown vaccine, which is what most people get. However, I'll point out that there are four strains of influenza in the vaccine, and there are other strains circulating right now. There's a little bit of flu B around, and the viruses continue to circulate in Rochester anyway, usually until May. So the vaccine would be protective against those other three strains quite effectively. We also know that the vaccine is more and less effective in different age groups, and that's probably based on the influenza viruses you saw earlier in life and the kind of immunity that you have. Not everybody's equal, right? We didn't all see the same viruses. We weren't all born at the same time.
When it comes to why the virus mutates and what we know about that, I mean, it's very hard to predict year to year, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I mean, we try to monitor what's circulating in the southern hemisphere during their winter, mm-hmm. And that tends to be the predominant strain that circulates in our winter. But it is a guessing game, and you know, things unexpectedly happen when we manufacture the vaccine as well. So the problem with this year's vaccine was something that happened when they grew the virus up in eggs.
By the way, if I missed this, forgive me, but do we generally, are we putting a number on how effective the vaccine is this year?
We don't have that data yet.
Okay.
From the U.S. That data will not probably be available for a bit of time.
Is there any benefit to knowing what it was a year ago, or has everything changed that
much? What we have is information from the Southern Hemisphere,
okay, gotcha,
which suggested that this year's flu vaccine was not going to be very effective.
Does that mean 30%? 40, 20.
Probably less than 40.
Less than 40.
Yeah,
okay.
The reports that there was a report about a month ago that came, I can't remember if it was CDC or NIH, but it was estimated at about 10%, which is historically much lower than usual. Flu vaccine tends to be anywhere from 30 to 60% in most years.
Okay, let me get back to your phone calls. Michael in Canandaigua next. Go ahead, Michael.
Hi, Evan. Thank you for taking my phone call.
Sure.
I was curious if high-intensity interval training or high-intense training does anything to your immune system and lower it to make you more susceptible to getting sick. Because it seems like about every March when I'm really ratcheting up my training for summer biking, I seem to get sick. And last year, for the first time in close to 30 years, I missed 3 days of work because of what turned out to be the flu.
Okay. Stay there, Michael. I appreciate that. Go ahead, Dr. Walsh.
Well, as a former marathon runner, I've actually had some interest in the possible effects of heavy intensive training and racing on the immune system. And there are some studies, not many, that do suggest that the heavy physical activity can suppress your ability to fight infections for a brief period of time, although the data is not solid. And I think the caller's influenza probably had nothing to do with the intensity of his training. In all likelihood, he obviously was exposed to someone with a flu and became infected.
Okay, and when you say there's some data, we need more and better data, but if there is a link with high-intensity training, it's a temporary blip or change?
Well, there's really not much data on this, but there has been some people who have studied the influence of, say, marathon racing and their immune system in the immediate post-race period.
Okay. Michael, does that help you?
Yes, it does. And a side question, and I feel kind of ignorant asking this, but in 1986, I was in a pretty bad car accident and had a splenectomy. Does that affect at all my chances of getting the flu? I mean, I usually don't get the flu shot, but I did this year. Hmm. So I'm just curious if that has any effect.
Doctors.
All right. The effect of having a splenectomy is usually to increase your risk for bacterial infections, certain encapsulated bacteria, not specifically so much the viruses. But we certainly encourage anyone who's had a splenectomy to have a flu vaccine. And this goes back to the issue of the bacterial infections that can follow or occur at the same time as influenza.
Michael, good luck to you. Thank you.
Great.
Thank you for the phone call. Hope that helps you. The phone's ringing. You got some more time, about 10, 15 minutes for more calls on the flu and related issues. If you've got them, it's 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. I'll follow up to Michael's question on high-intensity training by showing you just how much probably doctors get driven by nuts by people like me who self-diagnose or self-prescribe. So I was born with Wolff-Parkinson-White syndrome, and I had a catheter ablation about 20 years ago, and no real signs of it's a heart issue, listeners. It's a small extra little piece of tissue that was a second electrical pathway, and sometimes my heart would crank up pretty hard and give me a little tachycardia. And so they zapped it, that's the medical term, about 20 years ago, and it worked out pretty well. But I still feel nervous about anything beyond a half marathon, and I've run a half marathon, and I think I read in Time Magazine, and now I'm speaking way out of school, but I remember from Michael's phone call from Canandaigua, reading in Time Magazine some budding but still not complete research on the effect of marathons on the heart. And marathons, at least for the next, I think, 2 to 4 weeks post-marathon, is your heart actually weaker? And maybe long-term, that's not the case, but Dr. Walsh, anything for me to be thinking about there? So my self-diagnosis and my prescription is no marathons. Half marathons, okay.
my sense would be that I would talk to a cardiologist. However, what you had, to best of my knowledge, is an electrical conduction disturbance, not a myocardial muscle problem. And so, therefore, I wouldn't think that you are at any particular great risk from influenza, nor perhaps from marathon running.
But I read on the internet. No, never mind. doctors, how often are you dealing with people who, in very well intended ways, self-diagnose for them or their kids? And do you get any pushback, Dr. Tessini?
I would say pretty often now, parents and patients are going online and accessing information, which is great to have more informed patients and be able to have a discussion. It does get difficult when you're trying to parse out what is true medical knowledge and what we would consider evidence-based information. Versus, someone's opinion that has now been put out on the internet. It's very hard to tell those apart.
Yeah. And I've got friends who, they always say, like, well, my mom and dad or my mom's sick. And I always try to tell them, do not get on the internet. You're going to make a determination that whatever the worst case scenario you find is going to be it, and that's going to lead to more stress. But I appreciate that, and it's good counsel. There's a lot of good information out there, but it's also good to talk to your doctors. That's what we're doing this hour, as we talk about the flu, and we make fun of the host a little bit for being too much of a self-diagnoser. Let me get back to your phone calls, and Sam in Rochester is next. Go ahead, Sam.
Hey, thank you for taking my call, Evan. I went in the hospital last year with the flu. And I found out that there was an A and a B. And they told me they had medicine for the A, but didn't have anything for the B. So I asked them, what was I supposed to do if I had the B? And they said, all we can do is send you home and tell you to consume lots of fluids. And I didn't think that was an answer, and a right answer, but I wonder if they got anything this year for it.
All right, Sam, stay there. Let's ask our doctors here. Dr. Ticini, you want to start? Go ahead.
So, yes, we do have different types of flu, strains, you might want to call them. And like Dr. Tapa mentioned, the vaccine covers 3 or 4 different ones. So depending on the vaccine you can get, 1 or 2 are for that, what we call the flu B. And the main specific antiviral medication we use is the also tamiflu that many people know as Tamiflu. And we do test that through the CDC and other laboratories against circulating viruses. And this year, the latest test that I saw, the viruses circulating were susceptible, except for, I think they had literally 2 viruses of a different type of flu A that's not circulating that much this year that weren't susceptible. So nearly all of the viruses that they've tested so far this season were susceptible to that medication.
And that would include influenza B.
Exactly, yeah.
Sam, does that help you?
Well, I'm glad they have something. Not that I'm looking to get the B. I didn't want the A, but I'm glad they do have it, you know, for other people who go into the hospital, because I'm a diabetic also. And that didn't help me any either, but I mean, I'm glad that they do have medicine now for the B.
Yeah, you know.
So I thank you for that.
I was going to say your best protection is not getting the flu, right? And the vaccine is the best way to prevent that from happening. Mm-hmm. So it's still not too late to get vaccinated.
Sam, thank you. Good luck to you. And thanks for calling as always. 844-295-TALK if you've got questions or comments on the flu, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI for calling from Rochester, 263-9994. On the subject of not getting the flu, Rob asks, if a person is going into an enclosed area with people coming from places around the world and they're going to be together for a long time, how can someone prevent themselves from getting the flu if some of those people likely have it? I guess it starts with a vaccine.
Yeah, well, it starts with the vaccine, certainly. Like I said, that's your best protection. We mentioned hand washing and good hygiene, but, you know, this is also an airborne virus. There are both anecdotes and actual studies of how viruses have spread on things like airplanes or even in a closed room. You know, sometimes there's nothing you can do. You just have to, you know, take your chances. I mean, you can't just stay home and, you know, be a hermit all the time, right?
All right, let me get to we got a bunch of other questions to work through. Good luck to you, Rob. Jane writes and says, I work in sleep medicine, and there is good data showing that insufficient sleep depresses the immune response for acute as well as chronic illness. Yeah? Yes or no? Doctors?
Yes. Any stress to the body, which lack of sleep is a stress on the body, it kind of wears it down I think that's a pretty appropriate term.
Get sleep. I don't know of any doctors who don't endorse getting a good full night's sleep all the time. And I also know lots of people, and I used to be in this category, used to say, I only need 5 hours sleep, 4.5 hours. I'm used to it. Well, you may get used to it, but I don't think your body wants you to get used to it. And I've heard that from many, many doctors. So thank you for that email. Let's see here. Mary Lou in Canandaigua says her mother lives in a senior living facility and the doctor recommends residents get a booster shot. What does our panel think?
There is, as far as I am aware, no evidence that getting a booster shot would be required. There are a couple of issues, though, with regard to that. In the senior living center, most of the people are going to be over age 65, and there is a high-dose flu vaccine that is approved and shown to be effective, more effective than the standard dose in that population. And so they can use that dose that vaccine to enhance their protection. The effectiveness of the flu vaccine does not wear off quickly enough in all likelihood, to require a booster dose.
Okay. Terry in Rochester next on the phone with our guest. Go ahead, Terry.
Yes, I was just wondering if, the N95 mask, would that help prevent someone from getting the flu?
So, theoretically, yes, but the problem with N95 masks is that you have to be trained to use them, and most people wouldn't, if they're not trained, wouldn't know how to use them properly. And so I would say, no, it's maybe give you a false sense of security that you're protected, but in reality, it probably wouldn't help you.
Okay.
Yeah. When it's been studied, it hasn't shown any more protection than what we consider a more standard surgical mask. And part of that probably has to do with it's hard to appropriately seal the N95 mask, and it's difficult to wear for any extended period of time.
Does that help, Terry?
Yes, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks for the phone call. In Fairport, this is Phil on the subject of Tamiflu. Go ahead, Phil.
Yeah, my question is, I'm in a high vulnerable age group, and I want to know, number one, how effective is Tamiflu, and when did they decide that a patient should be put in the hospital?
How effective is Tamiflu is first question. Let's hit that one. Doctors? Dr. Walsh, Dr. Tassini?
Yeah, Tamiflu is effective at reducing the duration of influenza, so it will shorten the course of it by a few days. It has also been associated in hospitalized individuals with a decrease in mortality rate. These, unfortunately, are not randomized control studies, but they are retrospective analysis of patients who've been treated. But they do seem to consistently show that the drug is beneficial.
But you have to get it within the first 3 days of having symptoms. After that, it's not effective. So, if you're developing what you think are symptoms of flu, and you can go to your doctor and get diagnosed, do that quickly, because otherwise it has less effectiveness.
That help you there, Phil?
Yeah, the other question is, how do they decide somebody should have to be put in the hospital?
Well, that's based strictly on your symptoms. If you're hypoxic, meaning your oxygen level in your blood is low because you're not breathing well, if your blood pressure was low, if you're unable to care for yourself, for instance, if you live alone and you're just unable to really care for yourself and eat, these would be reasons for hospitalization.
All right. Quick questions to close the hour. Number one, is it too late to get vaccinated for this flu season?
No. Never too late.
Never too
as
late
long
to
as
get
it's there.
Never too late to get vaccinated. And I know that. Let's see here. Sherry in West Irondequoit's got a question. Got to keep it tight. Go ahead, Sherry.
Yeah, thank you for your call. I'd like to know how high the temperature for a 7-year-old before I can give ibuprofen.
So how high does a fever have to be for a 7-year-old before you give her medication like ibuprofen? Dr. Tassini.
So I would want to consult with your child's pediatrician about what exactly is going on for giving the ibuprofen. But in general, it's really given for the patient's symptom and comfort. So it's really how uncomfortable are they. The temperature itself isn't harmful to children in vast majority of settings. So it's really given for your child's comfort.
There's no strict number. I want to make sure we ask Dr. Topham before we lose the hour here, questions about a universal vaccine. I know there's research that's happening around the world. University of Rochester Medical Center is involved in some of that research. The idea of to me it sounds like a vaccine where you wouldn't have to reinvent it every year. Or tell me what the goal is and how close we might ever be to that goal.
Yeah, so NIAID at the National Institutes of Health has set a goal of developing a vaccine that will protect provide a level of 75% protection from all influenza viruses and last at least 5 years. In other words, we wouldn't have to change it in 5 years. You might have to get the vaccine every year, but we wouldn't have to guess which strain. And so there are a number of approaches that are being tested right now. And we also do research at the university to understand how people respond to not only the virus, but different vaccines, because this will affect how you respond to a universal flu vaccine.
And so, are we hopeful that we are on the way?
We are hopeful. It's a pretty high goal. I think at a minimum, we will achieve vaccination strategies that provide more broad protection against different viruses. You know, our approach right now is what I call immune focusing. Right, we're targeting on just a few strains, and what we need to do is you know, find a way to get immune responses that cross-react with many influenza strains.
Okay, until we get to that point, people get their flu vaccines every year. And the last question of the hour comes from a listener named Michael, who wants to know if there is any long-term benefit to getting the flu shot every year, residual impact. In other words, if you're someone who gets it every 3 years, or you haven't gotten it every year, are you more compromised or more vulnerable, or is it essentially year to year?
I can feel that. So there are some studies that show that getting vaccinated every year can have a diminishing effect. The evidence for that isn't great, but it is there. I would recommend people get vaccinated every year. It's because the strains change all the time.
The strains continue to change, and I know it's been particularly more aggressive or more problematic this year. And our thanks to our guests for helping us understand it better this hour and taking a lot of listener questions. You just heard Dr. Dave Topham, director of the New York Influenza Center of Excellence, the University of Rochester Medical Center. Thank you so much for your time, Dr. Topham.
You're welcome.
Our thanks as well to Dr. Brenda Tessini, Assistant Professor of Infectious Diseases in the Departments of Medicine and Pediatrics at URMC. Dr. Tessini, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
And Dr. Ed Walsh, Head of Infectious Diseases at Rochester General Hospital. Dr. Walsh, thanks to you as well.
You're welcome.
All right, short break. We're talking about heart health next.